So I guess we'll go ahead and get started. So everybody, welcome, and please don't be distracted. Our recording equipment is much more primitive today than normal. So we'll just be passing the phone around when Doug talks. But yeah, so we're really happy you are all here tonight, and this is Doug, and he is our speaker for the evening. Doug has a master's in psychology counseling, which he achieved in 1984 at San Jose State, which is in California. He's been counseling for over 35 years, and he currently is the director of Southwest Counseling in Southwest Denver, where he has been for 17 years and oversees 27 counselors who conduct a combined total of 15,000 hours of counseling every year. Doug and his wife Joyce, who is also here, are passionate about helping people and about marriage and making marriages stronger. And that is the topic for tonight: is marriage and I'd say communication, but mostly marriage. So
they're not different.
But they're not different. So don't listen to me. Listen to Doug. Here is Doug. I'm going to give you that.
Yeah. Well, thank you again. Joyce is going to be joining us as part of the discussion. You need to be here to get recorded. Well, or I could just...
Tell me when you want me.
Yeah. Well, I don't know when you want to step out either. So thanks for coming. So the title for tonight is Marriage Enrichment. What does that mean? It's not marriage counseling. In marriage counseling, you're trying to find out what are the problems that a couple might be having, and how do you address those problems and help fix them? That's not what we're trying to do today. Marriage enrichment is look at your marriage and ask yourself, how are we doing together in our relationship? And where are we doing really well? And where can we grow? And so it's just a matter of, like you're doing an evaluation, like a checkup. How's our marriage doing, and what are areas we can do better? If you're married, we're going to have you do some things together as couples. If you're married and your husband or wife's not here, I'll show you how I want you to practice that, or your fiance. And so we'll take advantage of that. So we're going to go through this outline that you have first, and then we'll take a break. And during that break, I'm going to give you some homework to do. Yeah, well, yeah, if you're single, I want you to go through and learn, because what I hope and pray is that by going through this, you'll learn what healthy marriages look like. So when you're dating or considering marriage, or like Bobby there getting ready to begin married life together, that I hope it'll give you the solid, positive things to be looking for to build. Not just if you're married in your marriage now, but if you're going to get married some future day, or you hope to, for the future. So that's what we're going to try to do. Is that okay? So what I'd like to do is pray first, if that's okay, and then we'll jump in. Lord, thank you for each person here. Thank you for each relationship, each marriage they represent. For those who are single and want to learn, I pray, Lord, that you would speak to them according to your will. For Bobby and his fiance, prepare the way for them. Lord, thank you that you love marriage, and you've called us to have godly marriages, and not just to thrive ourselves, but to be an example to the world around us. So I pray that tonight, as we talk about these topics, that, Lord, you will speak to each of us. Lord, help us to grow because we spent this time together. In Jesus' name, amen. So this outline comes from a test called the ENRICH. The ENRICH is a marriage test that we like to use a lot, psychologists, pastors in America, because it gives a good way to kind of break down some of the key pieces or elements of marriage and see how you're doing in each area. And it's this test has been shown in research to really be the best predictor we have of a good marriage. If you do well on this, statistically, you're in a good marriage, and it's going to last a long time. I also like it because it's very, very practical, and hopefully at the end of the evening you'll feel that way. So we're going to go through each category. I'm going to give you a basic definition, and then you'll see the scoring system that I'll explain in a minute. And my wife Joyce here is going to join in as she wants to participate. She and I have been married almost 37 years, and I mentioned on Sunday we met in Uruguay, South America, so it was a long journey to meet each other. But we can never doubt the Lord had us for each other either. So the first area we're going to talk about is self-confidence. You'll see that under number one. Self-confidence means in your marriage, you are growing in a way to be more confident, better self-esteem. You feel like you're growing as a person. You're liking yourself better. You're learning to be encouraged. You feel like your spouse builds you up, encourages you, and affirms you. And you're growing in confidence. You feel better about yourself, better self-esteem. If this is not happening in a good way, then what's happening is you're feeling torn down. You're feeling like you're doubting yourself. You feel criticized or judged at times, like you can't really be who God made you to be. So the positive is you're being built up, and you're after marriage, you're more confident. You feel better about yourself today than you did before you ever got married in the first place. Now, on the scoring, you'll see a 1 to 10. 1 means low. It means you're not doing well in your marriage relationship in this category. 10 means you're doing great. I really feel much more confident, much better about who I am, much more confident. Hello. Does that pen taste good? Does the pen taste good? Yeah. So we're on self-confidence, just the first one. And so, and 10 means you really, because of your marriage relationship, you feel more confident, more secure in who you are. Your self-esteem has been built up. 5 would be in the middle. Now, because Jesus wasn't married, we never will know what a perfect marriage is, will we? I mean, if Jesus were married because he was perfect, we could say, okay, that's a perfect marriage. We don't have that. And I think that's because there is no perfect marriage. There's healthy marriage. So when you mark a 10, you're not saying, wow, this is perfect in our relationship. When you mark a 10, what you're saying is we do this really well. We build each other up. We're growing in confidence and self-esteem in our identity and who we are. So here's what I want you to do, and we'll each time pause in case there's a question first. But we want you to circle a number from 1 to 10, 1 being very poor, my marriage, I don't feel built up, and 10 being, this is an area we're doing great. Pick a number that you think best describes where you are at in your relationship. Circle that, but you can't cheat. You can't look at each other's. So husbands scored for themselves, wives for yourself. Yeah, for you, are you, neither of you is married? Okay, circle 10, because that's what you want. Yeah. What I hope both of you will get out of this as we go through it is think about, if indeed I get married, this is a sign of a healthy marriage. You shouldn't feel torn down. You shouldn't feel broken down. Instead, you should be built up. So put a prayer request by each one, just asking the Lord to give you
number 10
for whoever God has for you to marry in the future.
What I would add is, in our situation, Doug in particular, he has the gift of encouragement. There is such a gift. And so it was one of those gifts that the Lord gave me because I needed that. Doug has a lot of self-confidence. I needed a lot of encouragement. And so I would give him a 10, but he came by it very naturally, very easily. It's just very much who he is and the gifting, and probably being a counselor didn't hurt either. But it's not that he didn't need encouragement and being uplifted, but my need, my vessel was much emptier than his. And
especially her father tore her down quite a bit. He was a godly man, a good man, but he would react and he would be critical and tear her down. So that was part of what she had to grow from as she came into marriage. So take a minute. Yeah, questions first.
Just clarify, is this how you're feeling in the moment?
In the moment, right now, yes. So take a moment and score it for from your perspective, not from your spouse's perspective, but from yours. Russ and I were talking today about what if the man marks an 8 and the woman marks a 3? And I said, well, first of all, that happens in counseling all the time. Men say, oh, our marriage is fine. And the wife looks at him like, what are you talking about? And so this frequently is the case. But it indicates a much more serious problem, obviously, if there's that much disparity. But
could it be true, though, that in this in self-confidence that one is building up the other one, but the other one doesn't necessarily build up?
Right, because, you know, like Joyce was torn down more than she should have ever been torn down. It could be I try to build her up, but she doesn't receive it or doesn't, you know, her own self-doubt, which she's been great about growing in. But, yes, you're right. I mean, one person can't correct and fix somebody's self-esteem. But the point is, in the marriage, are you feeling overall built up? So just circle first as we go through this, just a number for yourself.
We just do the first one.
The first one. Just the self-confidence in 1 through 10, 1 being very low, not very, I don't feel built up in my marriage. I don't feel like I'm gaining self-confidence in our relationship. 10 being great, this is very strong. And yes, maybe one person feels this other spouse does a better job than they do. So, oh, she builds me up very well. The second category is couple satisfaction. How satisfied, happy, content, fulfilled do you feel in the marriage? Is it a marriage you like to brag to other people? You know, in our marriage, you know, we're doing great. We enjoy it. We like life. We encourage people to get married because it's meaningful and enjoyable. On the negative side, it would be, you know, it's just work all the time. It's not very satisfying. It feels like a chore, like effort and work and hard, as opposed to this is something that really builds me up and encourages me and is gratifying, satisfying. I feel content in my marriage. Any questions on that one? So circle a number for yourself today, how you see it today. Number 3, personality issues. So this has to do with your spouse's or fiancé or hopefully future spouse personality. So do you like them as a person? The areas, because we're always different people. Do you enjoy your differences? Have you, what's that?
That's a dangerous question.
Yeah, it is a dangerous question. You know, and there's a saying, opposites attract, and often that's the case. And then there's a saying, and there's a book written by a Christian marriage counselor that says, the title of the book says, opposites attract, and then the red line is drawn through it and says, attack. And often that's the case. You know, early on, you love your differences, the things that are different about each other. But over time, as you start living life together, you get to know each other, you deal with the reality. Some of those areas of difference can be annoying, can feel, you know, an area of conflict. Go ahead.
I said friction.
Friction.
Yeah. Like
say so you really like your husband's personality.
Well, you either really like their each other's personality, or even where there are differences, you've learned to accommodate them. You've figured out ways to make it work. Same thing with habits, traits, quirks. In our marriage, I'm kind of hard of hearing. I wear hearing aids to help me, and Joyce has super sharp hearing. She everything hears very, very sharply. So you can imagine there would be plenty of times where we're sitting in a room together and I'm not hearing very well and she's feeling overwhelmed. That's an example of, and we're very different and will always be very different. And so have we as a couple figured out how to manage that, how to navigate that? So introvert, extrovert is an example.
Go ahead. He's like off the chart extrovert. It's a continuum on the extroversion, introversion. I'm like in the middle. So it's kind of confusing sometimes. I need both. But if I have too much extroversion time, I need alone time so I can recover. I don't need a lot of that. But what I really appreciated about his extroversion was especially when we had children and I was home with the children, and it could be extremely draining. And he would come home even after spending an entire day counseling people, and he could transition immediately to playing with the kids, being with them, and I could breathe and do some recovery. And so in that regard, we were wonderfully matched in that regard. And also, sometimes I'm not ready to talk about things after a day at the office and difficult things that we're handling. And he wants to hear about it. And I have to say, well, I just really am not ready to talk about it. And he can be patient. And we have our little routine of how we relax and whatnot. And then I'm able to...
I have to wait until she's ready. Not when I want to do it.
Right. I'm like, nope, you're not going to get it yet.
And I'm such an extrovert, I don't like being by myself. I drive myself crazy. So the flip is opposite true. So when she's out in meetings or something and I'm home alone, I'm kind of miserable. I think I'm bad company. So
I'm the perfect balance.
Yeah. I'm definitely not balanced. I'm very extreme. So this area of personality is all about how you get along with each other. Is one of you very neat and another one messy? And have you figured out how to make that work? One of you is loud and one of you is quiet. But again, often the opposites make the initial attraction, but then after a while they become a little annoying. So anyway, give yourself a number how you see your own marriage or engagement or relationship there. Number four, this is what Russ was talking about, communication. Communication is an important part, obviously, of any marriage. And how well do you communicate with each other? And there's several things that I want to highlight on communication. When you have healthy communication, let's see how this works. It must go like that. When you have healthy communication, one thing you do is a lot of I messages rather than you messages. Do you know the difference? If I come up to you, I'll come up to you, Darren, just to pick on you just because. You make me so mad. Now, did I just, I used a you message. And did you can talk in a minute about what it feels like or what you all felt when I did that, versus I come up and say, I'm so mad at you right now. Does it feel the same or different? Was it same or different for you?
No, it's different, yeah.
When you use a you message, the initial reaction typically is the hair stands up on the back of our head, we put our wall up, and I want to tell you to be quiet and get out of my face, right? Well, and I'm mind reading. I'm telling you about you like I'm some great expert about you. We've been married for almost 37 years. I know her pretty well, but there's a lot about her I don't know. I messages were the second one I gave. I'm so angry at you right now. Adara, did you find yourself reacting differently?
It's an inviting conversation.
Yeah.
I can explore that with you, whereas the first one, you just want to defend yourself.
Right. So usually a you message, you do this. An I message, you do, you are? Why? And especially in a love relationship, you know, when you're in life together. So this is an example of good communication or bad communication, is you versus I. Another example is if my wife and I have something we need to talk about, person A and person B should talk directly to each other, work, resolve a problem. And this is healthy communication. Jesus in Matthew 5 talked about this. If you have conflict between you and someone else, what are you supposed to do? Yeah, leave the altar even, stop worship, get out of church and go talk to that person. Unhealthy communication recruits person C. And so A talks to C, and C goes to B. And then it goes back the other way. Now, there are okay times where this happens. So, for instance, Joyce would be at home with the kids, and maybe the kids have a problem with me, their dad. And they'll first tell their mom, Joyce, about it, and so she can tell me, so ultimately I and my child can work it out. That's an okay thing as long as it's limited. But when it gets patterned this way, the more triangles happen in communication, the more unhealthy, because now you're not really communicating very well. I was a missionary in South America, so I learned Spanish. So there were times, you know, I would talk with Spanish to people in the country. We'd talk back and forth. But there were times that I had to translate, like if somebody who only spoke English came, they would talk to me in English, I would explain in Spanish here, because they couldn't talk to each other. Again, that's okay, but I learned how hard it is to translate well, even when you're trying to be accurate. You know, you want to be as precise as you can. Often in relationships, oh, I can't talk to my husband about that, and you go complain to a girlfriend. Or a husband says, you know, my wife won't listen to me, she doesn't care, so I complain to a guy friend. We're forming triangles now. And the more, this is called triangulation.
I remember that particularly when we were in early marriage, and if you were a stay-at-home mom, and you'd get together with other moms, I found that a lot of the women would use that time to complain about their husbands. And that, for me, that was, I had made a commitment from the very beginning that I would never participate in that kind of conversation. And I only wanted to speak well of my husband. And
Bill, or not at all.
Or not at all, right? But it's a common thing, especially with young marrieds, I think, for the women to complain. And it only tears the marriage down and the communication.
So we're on number 4. We're kind of going through category by category, explaining what they mean. Number 4 is at the top of page 2, defining what it means. And then we're asking each of you to score for yourself. How would you rate your own marriage in this area? when you number one means we're not doing well at all. We've got a big problem here. 10 means we're doing great. And so you're going to try to rate, well, where, but initially now, just rate it for yourself, not for your spouse, and how things are right now, how you would say you think about them. So we're talking about communication right now.
Which is on the second page.
Top of the second page. And we're talking about some things that relate to good communication, using I messages rather than you messages. So the example, and this is, I'm playing, so don't take anything personal. But if I come up to you and I say, you make me so mad. So now I used a you. Or I come up to you and say, you know, I'm so mad at you right now. Do you react same or different? And we're saying, you know, I'm sorry to pick on you, but, well, I'm not. Usually when it's I, it's like I'm taking personal responsibility for my feelings, my thoughts. I'm not blaming you for them. You made me mad. No, it's my anger. I'm responsible for my own anger. So when I say you, I'm blaming you for something that isn't your fault. If I say I, I'm taking personal responsibility, and it's true. And we were saying you, usually people kind of back off. They get defensive or get out of my face kind of thing. And if you say I, they say, oh, really? Why? Why are you mad at me? It sort of draws them into conversation. And especially in a love relationship, don't do this with the person in the grocery store, but in a love relationship, hopefully where you're committed to have a great marriage together, makes a difference. And then we were talking about triangulation. There's a couple other things. One of my favorite communication verses in the Bible is James 1:19. Anybody know that one? Be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. Think about that order. Quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to anger. Imagine communication if we really work hard to listen to each other. Do you like that when your spouse tries to listen to you? Even if they don't understand, well, at least they're trying. And slow to speak. I talked about this at the seminar we were doing for suicide and depression. One of the things that's always good to do is ask three questions. Don't just respond right away. Stop and listen and ask some questions. If somebody says something, pause, listen first before you speak. So this is another example of communication that I like. For a couple to have good communication in a marriage, you must feel safe. You must feel like they care what you are saying or thinking or wanting or needing, and that it's safe for you to express it. If you feel like, oh, I can't say that, they'll get mad, now we're talking about a breakdown in communication, and things are going to be held back. Does that make sense? Any questions? So give yourself a score in your marriage. Circle a number in terms of your own view. Number five, conflict resolution. How many of you love conflict? How many of you hate conflict? Yes. Why is that? Why do we hate conflict? It's normal, right? Happens to everybody. Well, conflict resolution means that we find healthy ways in our marriage to work out our differences and resolve conflicts. And it takes a strategy. We can't just be upset or disagree on something and it magically fixes itself. Have any of you found that it works that way? And what a lot of couples do is avoid it. That'll work. If I just never say anything or try, it magically gets better. Think about that in your future husbands. You're just silent and they just get better. Problems magically resolve. And so conflict resolution means we have a strategy, we have a purpose, a way, because we know conflict's going to happen. It's natural. It happens to all of us. And we're all sinners. I can be really mad at her, but I'm as wrong as whatever I think she's wrong.
You don't get mad at me.
Because conflict is normal. When we first married, one strategy we tried came out of Ephesians chapter 4, and it says, be angry, but sin not. Don't let the sun go down on your anger, in so doing, giving the devil opportunity. So think about that. Be angry. That's a command. God's telling you, be angry. It's an imperative command. It's like, wait a minute, God, I thought you didn't want us to get angry. No, we're to be slow to be angry. We're not supposed to be hot-tempered or angry a lot. But still, when we do feel it, he says, be angry. Then he says, don't, this is Ephesians 4, is it 26 and 27? Don't sin. So handle your anger properly, correctly. Don't do something harmful with it. Do something helpful. And don't let the sun go down on your anger.
We were talking about this today. That I know many times for me when I've been angry, upset about something, I need more time to process it and to calm down. So to try and resolve things late at night or before the sun goes down and I'm tired, end of a stressful day, I'm already upset, that is not ideal for conflict resolution.
Yeah, we started as Christian couple to do this literally. Don't let the sun go down on your anger. Okay, we'll stay up. We won't go to sleep until we resolve the conflict. How well do you think that worked? And you know, it's really hard to have a good argument at 10 or 11 at night because you're tired, you're impatient, you're at your worst, not at your best. So we decided, don't let the sun go down on your anger in our marriage. We were going to do it metaphorically, symbolically. We were just going to take it as deal with it quickly. Don't let it take 2 or 3 days and build and fester. Deal with it as quickly as you can, but go to sleep. Get a good night's sleep. And we found the next day, if we waited, and we say the next day, we still do this today, say, okay, we need to talk about it. Obviously, we've got a conflict here. When can we talk about it? And kind of set a time in the next day or two so we both have a time to think about it, pray about it. So when we do talk about it, we're a lot in our better behavior. It's always a conflict. When people are mad and shoot off their mouth and say mean things, do you think that's really what they think or feel that's true, truly in their heart? Or do you think that it's not really what they think or feel? Because some people will say both things. Well, when you're really mad and said that, you really meant it. And some people will say, I didn't mean it. I was mad and I was trying to hurt you back. I was trying to counterpunch. And so the reality is getting conflict into a fight is not ever going to be helpful. So you want to move it from fighting to conflict. What's the point of a conflict? Why does God allow conflict? Well, we're all sinners and it helps us to come to some resolution. Is this making sense? Now, how do you resolve a conflict? What are healthy ways to do that? Well, there's 3 ways that I want to talk about briefly. The best one is win-win, where she feels like she won, she got what she wanted, and I feel like I did. So maybe we're arguing over money. How do we spend money to do something, or one of our kids, or something we disagree on? It's always good when you have a conflict to say, okay, how can we work together to end up with a win-win, where we both feel like we got what we wanted? What do you need? What would help you here in this area? Here's what I need. Here's what would help me. So let's see if together we can find, look for a solution where we could find a win-win. Now, what most people do in conflict is they think of two things, and then they stop. They turn the brain off. Well, either we could do it her way or my way. To it, right? Now, how creative was that? How helpful was that? How much of the Holy Spirit's leading do you think was there? So normally, to come up with win-win, you have to stop and think. Just the first things that come to your mind are almost always bad. So you need to just kind of let them come in and out of your brain and then say, okay, what are some possible options that might actually work? And look for a win-win. The second thing to do is compromise. Okay, so we're going to give her some of what she wants, can't get everything, going to give myself some of what I want. And, you know, in an ideal world, it's 50-50. Well, she gets half of what she wants, I get half of what I want. Now, I don't know who decides that. I don't know who the expert on 50-50 is. But it's kind of an idea of a goal. But compromise isn't always 50-50, but we're... She has to give some, I have to give some, but we come up with a mutual agreement where we can both say, yeah, I can live with that. And
would you give me an example of that win-win situation?
Uh-huh. An example? Do you, anything come to mind?
I always win.
Well, you know,
I was trying to think of a recent one, and it's not coming to mind.
Yeah, we were talking today about one of our daughters, our middle daughter, who's very angry and aggressive and difficult, and she gave us a lot of trouble growing up. And often win-wins, we had to confront her bad behavior, but a win-win for us was she expressed her opinion as the mom, what she thought and felt, me as the dad. And then we'd put our heads together and say, okay, how do we want to handle this situation? A discipline, a strategy. It could be on something much smaller. We get up in the morning and, you know, I want to sleep in and she wants to get up early and go for a walk. Now, how do you find a win-win there? Well, we walk and I sleep while we walk, right? No. So the idea might be something like, great, we'll let you sleep a little bit longer and then we'll go for a walk right after that. And she'd say, yeah, that sounds good. And I'm say, I like that too. That would be a win-win. Those are simple examples.
So how is it different from a compromise?
Compromise is where we can't do that. She can't be fully happy and me fully happy. Okay. So we have to kind of mutually agree where we both give and take a little bit on something. Yeah. The third category is trade-off. Sometimes you cannot agree at all. Things are just totally opposite from each other. So trade-offs mean, okay, today we're going to do what you want, and tomorrow we're going to do what I want. That's a trade-off. They can work okay as long as they feel just, as long as they feel fair. When it feels like she always gets her way and I never get my way, or I always get my way and she never gets her way, then that's not trade-off, that's controlling. Trade-off is there's a sense of fairness to it because we go back and forth.
I was thinking this isn't so much as it relates to a conflict, but... like if one of you is an early bird, wakes up really early, and the other sleeps in, needs more sleep. So it's changed in our relationship, but one of the compromises that he made is he would get up early and have his quiet time and his coffee and let me sleep longer. We also had animals at the time. We only have one horse now, but we had several. And so he would do the morning horse tours and whatnot so that I could sleep a little later. But then he brings me coffee in bed to help wake me up very gently.
And it's in my best interest, too. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so it's something that...
So that's kind of a trade-off. I do everything in the morning then in an exchange for...
No, but I do all the chores at night.
Yeah.
So,
well, during the day, yeah. So conflict resolution has to be deliberate. It has to be intentional. You got to have a strategy. You got to be looking for ways that you both walk away feeling like something good happened. You may not have gotten everything you wanted, but something good happened. So rate on that scale how you think you're doing in your marriage with resolving conflict. Financial management is just what it says. How do you manage your money? How do you handle bills, pay bills, save, manage debt? What was that? And are you able to talk about money? Is it like you can't talk about it, or somebody gets upset, or can you talk about it? Do you work out a budget together? When we first married, we agreed that if we'd, either one of us could spend up to 50 U.S. dollars as long as we told each other that night. But anything over that, we would never do without talking to each other first. That was a financial agreement that we made. Because that way neither one of us would go do something crazy without talking to each other first. But financial management is, do you manage the money well? Is it orderly? Who pays the bills? One of the questions couples often have is, should we have all our money in one joint account or should we have separate accounts? How does a couple work those things out together? There's been a lot of studies about money, and this will come as a great shock to all of you, but women and men view money differently. Isn't that amazing? And study after study have shown this over and over again. Women tend to view money as a security, a protection, something that provides for them. There's a sense of stability with it. And men view money as a tool. You get out there and make something happen, do something that you want or need, or make it, I call it a power tool. You know, get out and do something with it. It empower, for a man it's often empowering, for a woman it's often about security, stability. And so because it's the same thing, it's a euro. We're just talking about money here, but we've approached that euro very, very differently from each other. So do you as a couple, how do you feel like you manage your money? Can you talk about it, or is it create conflict? Is spending under control by both of you, or is one of you spending and one of you isn't spending, or you don't like how money's being handled, or maybe you don't know how much money's in the account, how much debt do we actually have? And like in our marriage now, Joyce pays the bills, but I always know what's going on. And if I don't know, I'll ask her, or we'll look at the account or whatever it might be. So financial management is all about how you manage your worldly assets.
When we were first married, we had been single. We got married a little bit older. You wouldn't consider it older now, but it was back in 1982. And we had to be really deliberate about talking about, like, it wasn't this his car and my car.
Yeah.
That's just an example of a car, but we had lived independent lives and they were our things, my things, his things. And we We deliberately worked to change the language on that. So it was our car, not his or yeah. her.
And both of our names are on all of our titles of everything we own. We're equal owners on everything. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was really important to me, especially that it wasn't just his name on everything. I wanted it to be joined. But but anyway, that was an exercise for a young married person that it helped us a lot get over that, to be one in that regard.
So take a minute and circle a number. How well do you think in your marriage you're handling your finances? Are you comfortable with it? Do you have a plan? Does it feel chaotic or organized? Number 7, leisure activities. Do you know how to play and have fun together? Are there interests, hobbies? Do you like to get out and do recreational things together? Do you know how to play together? No? Well, what's the problem? Yeah. Well, if there's no time for leisure, then you're leaving something really important out of a relationship. There was a big survey done with something like 30,000 couples in America, and they listed what were the top 5 needs of women and what were the top 5 needs of men in marriages. And it was an interesting survey. In this one, recreational activity scored very high for men, higher than for women. That having a partner, somebody we can go out, we were on the prom together today, drinking coffee and on the prom. For us, that was wonderful. We love the beach and do that. For us, that's something we enjoy together. But leisure, healthy couples have fun together, do family things together, play, recreate, rest. And if you like to read or watch TV or go to a movie or something fun, that's something you build in your relationship. A win-win movie would be, yeah, I'd like to see that. How about you? Yeah, I would too. A compromise would be another romance movie? I don't think so. Let's find something, you know, that we don't have to watch everything blow up and be killed, but I can't handle any more romance. A trade-off would be, we'll watch a romance movie tonight, and then next week we'll watch a shoot-em-up.
You don't like Hallmark movies all the time?
Do you have Hallmark Channel here? Yeah.
I know for us, one of the things that he loved to do and he grew up doing was fishing.
Yeah.
That was really important to him. And I love the outdoors, but I was no fisherwoman. And so I asked him to teach me how to fish. So I joined in on his activity. And I really enjoyed it because I turned out to outfish him most of the time.
She beat me all the time. So it's like, wait a minute, that's not fair. She'd catch 4 fish and I'd catch 2. But
they just liked how I smelled better or something. Anyway, our youngest daughter just got married back in September. And one of the things they love to do is fly fishing together. But she didn't know how to fish or fly fish. And so she did the same thing. She just joined him in what his favorite thing was. And now they're both exceptional anglers and catch these massive fish. It's insane to us what they catch. But she fully enjoys it.
She does remember some of the fishing, but we got horses and we went into the horse world. So the girls, we have 3 daughters, they all loved it. So that was, for many years, part of our leisure activity, was to do that together.
But it became, it's a shared passion for them now, so.
If you're a couple in your marriage, you don't have fun together, what's going to happen to your love? What's going to happen? I mean, life is just a chore then. It's just work. Who likes to work all the time? Laugh, play, have fun, rest, recreate, do all those things. By the way, this is most pastors and missionaries are terrible at this. They're all about working, all about doing God's work, and they're not very good at playing. And so in my counseling with pastors and missionaries and Christian church leaders, I get on them about, you got to knock this off. Because the husband easily, the pastor, the missionary, the worker, often the man will become workaholic and the wife will be home with the kids and managing life and get more and more depressed and feel more and more lonely or abandoned.
Isolating.
So anyway, it's an area that ministry couples have to be very aware of as well. So rate that one. Do you have hobbies together, interests? Do you have fun, laugh, play? Number 8, everybody's favorite, the sexual relationship. You'd be no surprise to know this is number 1 for men on their 5. Are you able to enjoy your physical sexual relationship together? Not just intercourse, but touch, cuddling, kissing, holding, sitting together, physical intimacy and touching. Is this something? Now, men and women are never the same on this, and it's one of my questions for God. I have a list of questions when I get to heaven I'm going to ask God. And one is in the whole sexual area, God, what were you thinking? Because they're so different from each other. And I can imagine what answer I might get in heaven. But anyways, the fact that we're different forces us to compromise. It forces us to look for win-win, to work on a relationship. But in a healthy marriage, it's something you work out together. You value the sexual relationship. And you're able to talk about it. Some couples have difficulty using the words and using the language and talking with the words. And one of the things I'll do in pre-marriage counseling when I work with couples who are hard like that is I'll give them a book on sex written from a Christian perspective, and I'll ask them to go through it, reading it out loud together. Now, I never ask a dating couple to do this. The temptation is too great. But once they're married, just to get used to using the words and talking about the whole physical sexual area. Learning to please each other, being able to share together, this is what I love about our sexual relationship, this is what I don't, this is what I need or want, and vice versa. Making it safe to have conversation. I said yesterday in the sermon, one of the books of the Bible that's actually been banned in some countries is a very sexual book in the Bible, Song of Songs, or in some versions it's called Song of Solomon. But because God created sex and encourages it and wants it, and he presents a picture of passion and intimacy, and again, not just intercourse, it includes intercourse, but also all aspects of the physical passion and intimacy.
Doug likes a lot of touch. I don't necessarily need as much, but once I understood that was one of his love languages.
I always want to hold her hand or touch.
Touch me. And, yeah,
I like that.
Touched.
Contact.
Right. Yeah. And so I worked hard to be intentional about that, even though it wasn't necessarily something I needed as much as he did. But so, yeah, if you see us holding hands together, it's because that's a love language for him.
She's sacrificing for me. So.
Yeah. It keeps my hand warm, too, yeah. In Ireland.
So put a number. How do you think you're doing in your marriage?
Where does that come on the women thing? You said the sexual issue.
Women, it doesn't appear on their top 5.
At all.
For women, communication is number 1 for women.
What are women's top 5?
Yeah, well, communication, financial provision, a sense of security or provision, shared interests, so feeling like there's something, you know, that we care about each other and we enjoy life together. I'll get back to the last 2. But for women, it's all about connection and relationship. You know, the emotional, the conversation, the connecting that way. And the financial one was about provided for. They feel like their husband cares about them and is doing what he can to provide for them financially.
So it's completely imbalanced.
They were completely different.
Emotional.
All five were different.
It'd be emotional intimacy?
Yeah, emotional intimacy was, you know, part of it, yeah. So a lot of times that's another area where men and women are so different that we have to find ways to talk about it and come up with a strategy, create compromise, trade-off, or win-win. So if we have sexual relations more often, I'm happier, which is better for her. You know, that's a win-win, right? I'm making that up, but anyway. I'm old enough that that's not as much of a problem as it used to be. So rate your sexual relationship. Next is children and parenting. So are you on the same page raising children? Do you agree with parenting strategy? If you don't have children yet, talk about if and when you do have them, how do you want them raised? What values are you trying to instill in them? What about discipline? What do you believe the Bible teaches about being godly parents? Do you feel like you're together with your children? One of the worst things parents can do is let children split them. So I go to dad and tell dad one thing and dad gives me something and then go to mom and get something else. Or try to make mom say something and then they can come to me. Well, mom said blah, blah, blah. Well, okay, then I need to support it for now, and we need to talk privately if it's something I don't agree on. But children will try to, it's called splitting. They'll try to split the parents and manipulate parents that way. So we have similar values, parenting strategies. We're talking regularly about our children and what we think is best, and maybe we're reading some parenting books together. If you don't have children, obviously this isn't a category you need to worry about. But if you do want to have children someday, again, it's an intentional thing. It's a deliberate thing. It's not accidental. Most of us, you know how most of us parent is the way either we were parented, how our mom and dad handled us, or if we hated that, how we don't want to be like mom and dad, but we're not exactly sure what we want to be like. We kind of make it up as we go. So, hello.
How many of you were raised in a home where your mom said, just wait till your father gets home?
Did you like that? Were you happy to see dad come in the door?
I was terrified of my father.
Yeah.
Because that meant that he would discipline and It wasn't good.
But their dad hit kids with a belt and left them bruised and welted, which is child abuse now, but it's what he did back then.
But that's, pardon?
It wasn't
yeah.
That was the norm.
But that,
you respected the belt.
Yeah. If you're going to spank in the butt, my advice is always use your hand, because you know you can feel how hard you're hitting. And only in the butt, and it should stop about age 9 or 10. You should never spank at older than that. But if you use an object, a hairbrush, a belt, a stick, you don't, because of the speed of it, you don't really know how hard you're hitting. But if you use your hand, at least you feel how hard you're hitting. Now, I've had parents say, oh, but isn't that bad? Because when they see your hand, they're going to think of you swatting their butt. And the answer is, I've never seen that happen so far, because I don't regularly ask my daughters to pull down their pants or lift up their skirts so I can whop them in the butt. You know, it's unusual. It's different and it's very specific. And it never taught them to fear my hand in that way. So when you use, her mom used to use hairbrushes and break the hairbrush over them.
Apparently, I really needed
it. Look how great she turned out.
What a brat I must have been. They said I was sassy.
As an adult man, my parents just tried to raise us kids but didn't seem to know what they were doing, and I couldn't tell you what they were trying to do. It just like surviving, like just making life day by day. They took us to church. I worked with my dad, he wanted me to learn how to work hard and took me to church to learn about God. But strategy, what were you trying to teach me as my father? What kind of man were you wanting to raise me up to become? I had no idea. And it would be terrible to have a shrink, a psychologist for a son, I think, because I asked questions. So I went to my dad one day and I said, Dad, I want to know what qualities were you trying to build in me? And how are you trying to raise me up to, what kind of qualities and characteristics were you trying to build up in me? And you know what my dad did? He didn't even know how to answer it. And he said, well, we just survived. We just did the best we could. And then I asked my mom a question like that. So, Mom, what did you try to build in us? What qualities were you trying to raise up in us? And she cried. And then she said, you guys understand those things so much better than we do. She was just in survival mode.
How many of you were there? Mommy asked. There could have been like 12 or so.
Yeah.
Three.
Yeah. Three. So parenting and children and parenting means you're intentional. You know what you're trying to do, and you're taking reasonable steps to get there.
The reason I
anticipate from your kids in 10 years time.
The reason I mentioned what I did as it related to my father is because girls really get their sense of self-esteem in their relationship with their father. And so when you have such a conflicted or you're terrified of your father, it really has a negative impact on a child's, a female's self-esteem.
And as a father of three daughters, I never lost sight of that. You know, God the Father, when they read that in the Bible, God is their father, who are they thinking of? They're thinking of me for better and worse. And so it's like, we better be working to be as godly as we can. None of us are perfect. We're going to make mistakes. But try to be the best role model we can be. How about discipline? Do you agree on how to discipline? Spanking, time out, taking things away. And good discipline from a parenting standpoint has both negative and positive. Sometimes when people think of discipline, they only think of the negative. Well, I'll yell at them, I'll spank them, I'll tell them to be quiet or send them to their room.
Ground them.
Those are things you could do. What about on the positive side? How do you try to discipline them and reward them in a positive way? So identify a problem behavior in your child that's really bothering you that you don't want them to do. And instead of just yelling at them all the time, find a way to reward them. You know, if you do this better, then I'm going to reward this. We used to have charts on our refrigerator when the children were younger growing up, and we'd put certain behaviors that we wanted them. You know, younger was pick up their toys, brush their teeth, make their bed in the morning. As they got older, it was do the homework or different things. And we'd let them buy their own stickers, so they thought that was cool. They got their own very own type of sticker, and they'd put the stickers on, and when they had a certain number, they got a reward. They may have gotten some money to spend at a store. They may have gotten an overnight with a friend at their house. They got some kind of reward for it. That's positive discipline. So in discipline, it's negative and positive. Think about it, your work. Do you like just negative discipline? You get ignored at work unless you make a mistake, then you get yelled at. If that's what you work as adults, you probably don't like that. You hopefully get a pat on the back and say good job or thank you, or you get a bonus or a raise, or you get something that's on the positive side. So good parenting and child rearing includes discipline, and discipline includes both positive and negative. So anyway, how are you doing? Rate yourselves in the relationship. And if you don't have kids yet, do you feel like you're beginning to at least talk about this and come up with a strategy? Do you two have kids?
Yes.
Okay. So part of it for you is thinking about what kind of father, you know, or stepfather influence would you want? What do you should know about your kids? What do they like? What kind of men do you want, you know, qualities in a man would you like to see that you think would help your children grow? Family and friends, number 10. This includes extended family, so parents, uncles, aunts, cousins, and it includes friends. It could be people at church, it could be neighbors, it could be outside. Do you as a couple have friends? Do you have relationships with each other's families? And is this something you're able to work at together? You feel like you have a good strategy and approach for that? And do you don't just stay to yourself, but do you let yourself be in relationship? Do you pick healthy friends? Do you like each other's friends? You know, is it a case where the husband says, well, I like him, but the wife says, but I don't like her, you know, where there may be a disagreement? Or are these couples where, yeah, I like him, you like her, we're, you know, we can enjoy it together? An extended family, that can be very tough. You know, in marriage, you marry the one you love and you get the family connected as an added bonus. And sometimes that's good and sometimes it's terrible. And, you know, but you don't get to choose it. It's like you got to put up with it.
You're looking at me.
You're laughing.
You said sometimes it's terrible.
I was like, what's happening with my family?
Our daughter married a guy who our family, he loves our family and he wants to be with us all the time. Well, what happened to him? His father died when he was 10?
He was 12.
12.
From brain cancer. Yeah.
And his mom's an alcoholic and his brother's a drug addict. So that's a terrible extended family. Now, we encourage them to stay in relationship, including our daughter and our son-in-law. We don't want them to cut their family off. But they always want to be with us every holiday, every special day. Now that we're here in Ireland, they're at our house taking care of our horse for us. Because he talks about it all the time. You're the family I never had. His family was terrible. Now, again, a part of them as a couple, they need to find a way to make sure they're still around his family, even though they can be pretty toxic people. So sometimes you like what you get in your extended family, and sometimes you don't. But, of course, you may not like your own family sometimes, and other times you do.
Well, we've tried to embrace his mom and brother as best we can.
And friends, do you have relationships with friends? Some of our best relationships Joyce and I have with outside friends are through our church. We have these small group Bible studies, and we've gotten into a small group with people we really like. And so we have five other couples, and those are part of our good friends that we do things with. So rate your marriage. How are you doing with family and friends?
So you're saying if you're friends together, so what if the wife has friends that the husband...
As long as you're both okay with it and you have some mutual ones, it's probably going to be fine. Are you okay with your husband's friends? Is he okay with the friends you have? But are there things you do together with other people as well? If it's very independent, it's going to become a problem.
When we were first married, we were in San Jose, and I was... My friends were back in Colorado, where my family was, and he had a bunch of his friends. And I quickly realized that we needed to make our friends, that he couldn't just hang out with his friends.
My single friends, single day friends.
And I didn't necessarily, they didn't endear themselves to me very well.
A couple were terrible. Just call it what it is.
Yeah. But we quickly realized that we had to work on building joint friendships, being around couples that we both enjoyed being around. So it changed some of the single relationships at that point. For the better, right?
Of course. She told me early on when we first got married, you know, that girl likes you. She's hoping you'll date her. And she said that about all these female single friends I had.
Before we were married, yeah.
And I said, oh, no, sir, they're just friends. She said, oh, no, that's not. That's... And, of course, she was right. I just didn't see it, obviously. So anyway, rate yourselves. How are you doing with family and friends? And then turn the page.
We digress.
Number 11, role relationships. This has to do with chores, division of responsibilities. This has to do with cooking and cleaning, vacuuming and dusting. It has to do with taking care of the car, taking care of the yard. It has to do with just, you know, laundry and shopping. It has to do with just life, the work that goes in life. How do you feel like as in your marriage you're doing? Does one of you feel like you do everything and the other doesn't do anything? Do you feel like, and again, 50-50, sometimes people say, well, you should do half and I should do half. And I don't know who figures out half. I don't know. Changing the oil in the car, how does that relate to dusting or mowing? Who knows? So the issue is for you as a couple that you feel like there's a sense of fairness. It's working right for you. In our marriage, right from the beginning, 37 years ago, I told her I hate to cook. And I was a single man. I had to cook for myself some, but I hate it. And she's an awesome cook. So I said, if you cook, I'll clean.
And the kitchen.
The kitchen, the dishes, clean up, put the food away, all of that.
I just thought I'd clarify.
Yeah, I don't clean anything else. Just that. But anyway, that's just how we did it. I don't know how it should be done. There's no right or wrong here. This is for you as a couple. Do you feel a sense of fairness? Are you able to do things and it feels right? And are things getting done? Or do you avoid doing things? Does a mess stay in the corner for a while and it drives you crazy because it's not being picked up? I'll never forget one young couple who came for counseling, and they had been married just a matter of a few months, and they were so mad at each other. And the wife was saying, I asked him to put his dirty underwear in a basket, and then I'll do the laundry after that. But he doesn't put it in the basket. He throws it on the ground, and we're getting a big pile of dirty underwear, and he won't, you know. And she said she would, if he'd put it in the basket, she would wash it. But he wouldn't, he'd just throw it down wherever he happened to take them off. And so she was mad. He knew she was mad. So what was his solution? He went to the store and bought a pile of brand new underwear. And he kept the pile getting bigger and bigger in the room. And because he was going to make her clean up. He didn't want to do it. And so they were in this major standoff over dirty underwear. Please don't do that. And so it's like, okay, wait a minute. You have a problem with underwear, but you have a much bigger problem. You're in a power struggle. And you're not working together. This is not conflict resolution. It's stupid is what it is. It's foolish. And so the pile got bigger and bigger of dirty underwear, and finally they came into counseling. Would you go see a counselor for dirty underwear? Yeah.
I will tell you that the compromise for us with he cleans the kitchen and I cook, I'm a messy cook. And I just am. And so, but it was really hard for me. I was raised in a traditional, very traditional family, and my mother would not allow any man in the kitchen, and that was her role, was to cook and clean and all of that, and she had a terrible time. She didn't think I was a very good wife because I would let him clean the kitchen, but he was adamant that he still is today.
Yeah.
And when I bake and there's flour everywhere, it's like, sorry, honey, but this was the deal.
And I love her baking, so I'm happy. Yeah.
Yeah, he kicks me out. And at the beginning, he really did have to kick me out of the kitchen and train me. No, this is going to be my job.
Her mom had such a hard time with it. And I said, you want your daughter to submit to her husband, right? Yes. Well, then if I don't want her in the kitchen cleaning up, she worked hard. She made us a wonderful dinner. I want her to go relax. And that's what I, as her husband, want. Don't you think she should submit and do that? Yes. But then it would drive her crazy because a man's never supposed to think that way. And women should be there doing that. It was a clash that she had the hardest time resolving. But it's, like I say, it's all chores. So it's not just the inside things. It's the outside things. It's the vehicles. It's the just making life work for the couple. So think about how you two handle your roles and responsibilities and give yourself a score there in how you see it today. The next one is spiritual beliefs. And believe it or not, this is true even for non-Christians. I find this very interesting. But, of course, we're Christians. We take it from a Christian standpoint. But even non-Christians, if they share a core spiritual belief or value, belief about God or even a supreme being or Allah or whatever it is, a force, part of what spiritual beliefs do for people is they organize life. They give purpose and meaning. It gives you ideas on how to handle hard times and good times. And of course, it's easier for me to talk about this from the Christian perspective. Read our Bible together, pray together, go to church together, but include the reality of God in every part of our life, our parenting, our leisure life, or in every part of our relationship. So shared spiritual beliefs is a critical thing. Even Paul warns, don't marry an unbeliever. Don't be unequally yoked. And that's for this reason. There's other reasons, but part of it is because if you believe one way and your spouse believes very differently or not at all, it creates so much tension, not just in the relationship, but philosophically. What do you think about evil? Where do you go to get comfort? How do you get help? That sort of thing. It's really interesting. There's been a lot of studies done on prayer and the impact of prayer. And a lot of these studies don't define it in a biblical or Christian way. They just say prayer. It could be meditation or prayer. And they found that prayer helps people heal faster, better outcomes of surgery, better mental health. I mean, the list of prayer, the benefits of prayer are huge. Well, we know when we pray to the Holy Spirit, that's God himself. But even a secular world, if they pray, if they think bigger than themselves, life is not just this. It's a worldview. It's a way of understanding life. And I find it interesting in research, this is one of the most important scales on this whole test. If you want to predict a happy marriage, spiritual beliefs is one of the five biggest ones, along with communication and conflict and satisfaction. It's really, really important. And of course, as Christians, are we incorporating our biblical worldview in our lives? Do we pray together? This is a big problem for a lot of couples. They don't pray together. Or when they pray, they kind of lecture each other. They're not praying to God. They're talking to each other. God, help Joyce understand that she... Am I praying to God or Joyce when I do that? And so a lot of times that really alienates Christians from, I don't want to pray. I feel, it's negative. It causes harm. So when you pray, you really have to open your heart up to the Lord on it. Incorporate biblical principles and teaching So from a Christian standpoint, this is an easy one to apply. If a Christian is married to an atheist, they're unequally yoked according to the Bible. This is much more difficult. How do you come up with a shared kind of spiritual worldview? So rate yourself in your marriage on that one. Assertiveness. Do you feel safe enough in your marriage that you can express yourself, be strong, tell the other person what you want, hopefully always in a respectful way, not in an aggressive. Assertive and aggressive are not the same thing. Assertive means I'm willing to speak up, express myself, assert my opinion, you know, press my point of view, but listen. Work on it together. Aggressiveness is very different, and we're going to come to that in two more numbers. That's never okay. Aggressiveness has no part in any marriage. But assertiveness. So how safe do you feel in your marriage to really step up and express your opinion, push for what you want, you know, speak up even if you think it might upset the other person? Do it respectfully, do it properly, but still express it. So it takes safety to be able to be assertive. You have to feel safe. I'm not going to get punished for it. Person's not going to bring it up a week later. Well, when you said that, you know, and use it in a negative way, it's going to be handled in the moment. So assertiveness, how free to be assertive, how safe to be assertive do you feel in your relationship? Avoidance is in many ways the opposite. We are not going to talk about that subject. Ooh, every time we talk, oh, it goes bad. Oh, no, I can't talk about that stuff. Sweep under the carpet. Pretty soon the carpet gets really lumpy and really bumpy. There's a lot in there. Avoidance is usually out of fear or insecurity, but rather than really work on something, and if it's a hard subject, it may take a while. Maybe you won't resolve it in one conversation. Maybe it'll take a while. Maybe you need to get counseling, talk to a pastor, pray about it for a while. Maybe you need to read a book on it together. Look for ways to resolve it, but not avoid. We're actually going to face it. We're going to, whatever it happens to be. A commitment to say, we are going to have a lump-free carpet in our house.
How is this different than assertiveness?
Assertiveness, in many ways, is the freedom to give your opinion and express what you want. Avoidance is walking on eggshells. I don't want to talk about that subject.
So is a 10, I feel like it's always eggshells?
Yeah, if a 1 would be, if we're doing this well, a 10 would be, we don't avoid. We're able to really address things when they come up. I don't feel like there's subjects we can't talk about together. A 1 would be, no, we're avoiding subjects. There are all these things we can't talk about, and we're just not, we don't feel safe, or maybe we don't want to. Maybe we're avoiding. Some people are avoidant themselves. They just don't like facing things. And last, partner dominance. This is aggressive, where you feel like your partner is controlling you, abusing you. Maybe they're physically abusive, maybe they're emotionally or verbally abusive and controlling. A 1 would be you feel very controlled, you feel scared, maybe you've been hit or grabbed or blocked from leaving a room, maybe you've been pushed, maybe verbally there's name calling going on.
Yelling.
Go ahead.
Yelling.
Yelling, things like that. That where you feel dominated or controlled by your spouse. Or like they're at least trying to. And maybe you fight back in a similar way. But this is aggressive. This is where you're really trying to dominate the other person, or the other person is feeling like you are dominating or controlling them. So here's what I want us to do now. Those of you who are couples, I want you to go find a quiet corner here somewhere and go through and show each other what scores did you give in each category and why. Why did you give the number you did? If you're here by yourself and you're married, I want you to circle the number on these things that you think your spouse would put. If they were here scoring for themselves, what number do you think they would have put in each of these categories? And if you're single, what would you, you know, we're going for tens here. So what would you, how would you define and look for these qualities in a future husband, if that, you know, if God has one for you? What are the things in them you're going to look for in each of these areas? All right? Are you clear on what I'm asking you to do? And so take about 20 minutes and go find a corner. And after a while, we're going to, I'll call you back and we'll do the next step together. What was that like for you? Hard, easy, weird? What was that like for you?
Good.
Weird. Weird. These aren't subjects you always necessarily talk to each other about, are they?
That's good. We just talked about the stuff that I didn't realize we should talk about.
Oh, okay. Good.
We're surprisingly we both talk about it.
Yeah.
Quite often.
And those of you without a spouse where you're trying to score your spouse if they were here, was that hard to think about that? How they might rate. Well, you'll see on the bottom of the last page a couple things we're going to talk about now. First of all of in every category where you both gave yourself a 7 or higher, 7, 8, 9, 10, pat yourselves on the back. Good job. That tells me that's an area of strength. You're doing well. Good job. Keep up the good work. Because marriage changes, right? Maybe we're doing great now and next year might be a little harder time. But if right now you're 7, 8, 9, or 10, you're doing great and you're probably enjoying your marriage. You're probably finding it pleasurable, fun, a partnership. Now, notice any categories where one or both of you put a 6 or lower. Wherever there was a 6 or lower by one or both of you, that becomes an area where you can do some growing and there's room to grow there. So here's what I want you to do. And you don't have to do it right this minute, but when you get home or whatever, here's what I want you to do. I want you as a couple, if you had any 6s, 5s, 4s, anything lower, I want you to think about what would need to change to make your score a half a point higher. So if you're at a 4 on conflict resolution, you know, we don't really resolve conflict very well and we end up yelling at each other and then we walk away mad. What would it take to go from a 4 to a 4.5? What would be a little improvement, a little positive momentum in an area? And I would ask each couple to just pick one area where you were 6 or lower and agree together, okay, you want to, on your own now, we won't do it here tonight, but when you get home or whatever, I want you to think about, okay, talk about together. Okay, you gave it a 6, I gave it a 5, whatever the numbers were. Maybe I gave it a 7, but you gave it a 6. What would it take to take that 6 and make it a 6.5? Make it a little bit better. Don't try to take all of them to 10. Don't try to go from 5 to 10. Try to go from 5 to 5.5. What would it be different? Does that make sense? So what could I change? Does somebody want to give us an example we could talk about? Doesn't have to be real. You can make it up, but an example. maybe our communication isn't very good. You know, I just feel like my husband or wife just doesn't listen to me. They don't want to talk. We kind of each do our thing, and we don't actually talk. We don't actually have conversation. So I rated it a 4. What are some things I might be able to do to shoot for maybe a 4.5? What might be simple little things that I might want to try to make it a little bit better?
Schedule a coffee date once a week.
Sure. We talked about, you know, some of the ways we communicate. Maybe have a little gentler tone so the person wants to engage with you more, where it doesn't feel quite so scary or intimidating. Maybe you're going to ask your spouse, hey, there's something I need to talk about, but I really need your attention. Can you tell me when you're ready and so we can talk about it? Rather than just try to, I got to talk now, and boom, go to Joyce, and I'm going to try to make her talk. Maybe it's a matter of, honey, there's something I need to talk with you about. It's kind of, you know, important to me. Tell me when you're ready, and let's schedule a time to be able to talk. That would be an example. Now, she can say, no, I don't want to talk to you. Get out of my life. But hopefully she won't. What, as a counselor, when there's a lot of conflict, when there's poor communication, there's avoidance, if there's dominance, one of the things I'll recommend to couples is go have a private conversation in a public place.
So they won't kill each other.
So I'll say, pick a favorite restaurant that has a booth kind of quiet in the corner, and have a conversation there in a pub. It could be, we were walking on the prom today on one of the benches at the prom or at the Coco coffee shop, and it's kind of crowded in there. I don't know how you underhear each other, but sometimes it's better to have a hard conversation where you still have privacy, nobody else is listening in, but you're in a public place. Do you act differently in a public place than at home? Hopefully. If you don't, that's a different problem. And so sometimes I'll recommend that. Okay, they'll say, there's a subject, and we both, whenever we try to talk, I hear this a lot, whenever we try to talk about money, we end up yelling at each other. That's one thing I'll say is I want you to create what is one part about money you want to talk about. Don't talk about money. That's way too big. It's way too complicated. So what is it about money? What's one thing about your finances that you want to talk about? Well, every time we talk, he wants to just go spend our money and I want to save it. Okay, so you want to talk about spending or saving. So make a date and tell each other ahead of time. Okay, we need to set up a time so we can talk about saving and spending and how we do it. And then go to your favorite public place with a private area. Don't get the microphone and announce it to everybody. And what do you think you'll do? You think you'll act differently?
I'll tell them where our favorite place is to talk about.
Yeah, Joyce and I have always found places at home where when our children were young, we used to always like to use the bathtub together. And so we taught the kids that when mom and dad are in the bathtub together, the door's closed, they're not allowed in. But, yeah. But they can knock or call through the door if they need us. But they're not allowed to open the door. So we taught them that early on. And so with young children, it's very busy. And sometimes with young children, it's good to wait till they go to bed. But then you're always exhausted. So all you want to do is sleep or lay down or be quiet. I don't want to hear any more noise. So we did it when the children were still awake, but we taught them. As we get older, we do different ways. Now we have a beautiful backyard and we have a porch swing in our backyard. And that's where we go to talk. We'll tell each other, time to go on, let's go to the porch swing. And it's relaxing, and we're outside. And then we're able to, we both go with a mentality that we're going to have a more serious conversation if we need to. And it could be innocent. It doesn't always have to be hard or heavy, but it's our place. Now, it's not public in a sense that it's in our backyard, but it's outside, so I suppose our neighbor could hear us. We don't yell at each other, but if we did, they could probably hear us. So think in terms of, look at your scores, whether your spouse was here or you're scoring for them, and in your mind at least, pick one of the categories. If there was a six or lower, and say, okay, what's one thing we might be able to try to improve that score just a little bit? So take a minute to think about that. And if, as a couple, you can agree to one, you can just point to it. You don't have to tell everybody around you. The other thing sometimes couples do, when there's a subject that they have a hard time talking about, the other nice thing you can do is write to each other first. And I'll tell couples, get a notebook that's private. It's only for the two of you. No children are allowed to look at it. You don't show it to your best friend. It's confidential. It's private. But I call it a marriage journal. In that book, you can write to each other, bring up a subject that's sensitive or hard to talk about, and write each other back and forth at least two times, and then schedule a time to talk about it. So let's say, back to my example of spending or saving, you know, and every time we try to talk about it, we get upset with each other, and he does this and she does this. One way to do that would be, okay, get a marriage journal and write each other. So one of you write first what you think about spending and saving and all of that. And then the other person, you don't tell each other, okay, read this now. You write it and you leave the book, and the person, when the spouse, when they're ready, takes it up and reads it. So they can emotionally prepare themselves. And then they read what the husband wrote first. The wife will read the book when she's ready. She knows it's there and he wrote something, and she'll read it, see what he wrote. Then she will write a response from her point of view. What does she want to say? And close the book and leave it. They're still not talking about it. He waits a while and he goes, okay, I'm going to check the book now and see if she wrote an answer. And if she did, he reads her answer. And he writes her a second note, close the book. She waits a little bit, says, oh, okay, I'm going to see if he wrote back again. And when she sees he did, she writes another answer. So now does that make sense? You've written each other twice. If you do it on computer, then password protect it. You don't want your kids or anybody else seeing it. This is private. Then after that, after you've written each other two times, then you say, okay, now let's talk about it. What happens when you write that way back and forth? Well, there's a few things I like. Number one, you're not face-to-face. I'm not, you know, saying, you always want to save and I want to spend. You don't let me have any fun with my money and, you know, whatever the escalation of the fight might be.
You,
all of that. Not I, but you, like we talked about earlier. So when we write, we're not face-to-face. We don't have that immediate pressure of the person right there looking at me, and I don't need a quick comeback. In fact, I can take time to think about what I'm writing. I can pick my words carefully. I'm not just blurting things out. I'm thinking about them and writing more thoughtfully, more carefully. And I can pray about it. Okay, Lord, how do you want me to say these things? So we can pray about it. We can be deliberate. And when we write, we don't have that face-to-face pressure. Then when the wife or husband reads what you wrote, again, there's no face-to-face pressure. You're private. You're on your own. And you're ready. You know when you look at the book what might be in there. So you're prepared. It's not like you're in the car driving somewhere and all of a sudden one of you mentions a difficult subject and boom, it's escalating quickly. This way it's much more calculated, much more deliberate. So the person can read the book, read the what's in the book when they're ready, and then thoughtful, careful, prayerful, write a response, and vice versa. And I always say, write at least twice before you talk, because usually the first exchange are things you've already said to each other. You kind of, well, you know, it bothers me that you never want to save, and you always want to spend, but I need to save to feel better, to feel safer. What if something happens to one of the kids or the car breaks down? Yeah, but you're always saying that, and I don't like to work all the time and feel like I can't ever do anything I want. You know, so the first exchange often is what you tend to already say to each other. And I find it's the second exchange that starts moving past the usual kind of argument point and moving you more toward a solution together. So this is another thing you can try. I call it a marriage journal. Does that make sense?
So would you like talk beforehand of, hey, I wrote, take a day or two? Because otherwise, if you read it and then you respond right away, it might potentially be rather passionate. Not that I would ever.
Why were you elbowing Russ when you said that?
So is it?
There's like, you can. What works for you?
Stepping back and taking time.
Yeah, I would rather people didn't write a super quick response. I'd rather you read it and took 24 hours and thought and prayed and then wrote. But, you know, the more touchy a subject is, I think you need to wait at least 24 hours. If it's not that touchy, maybe you don't need to wait quite that so long. But read it, think about it, process it, pray about it, ask the Lord what he wants you to do on it. But that's an example. I've had many couples say, oh, we really like this. It works so well. Is it okay if we write each other three times instead of two times before we talk about it? And I always laugh like, of course, if it's helpful, keep doing it. You will need to talk about it sooner or later. But if writing helps you kind of get some positive movement going, then that's a great thing.
Or maybe if you express yourself better in writing than verbally,
yeah,
it would be a good way to also express love and affection.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Not just a problem.
Yeah, it could be balanced. It could be loving and confrontive or whatever it needs to be, right? Versus when you're upset and just blurting out. And like I said, some people seem to think when you're angry and say something, that's what really came out of your heart. It's what you really believe. I don't believe that. I think we're usually out to hurt, we're not looking at ourselves saying, okay, Doug, what do you really feel? And then tell Joyce that. No, usually I'm just, bah! You know, it's not that thoughtful. But some people take it that way. And of course, words spoken can cause a lot of damage. We all know that. Words can be very, very hurtful. That's why the James 1:19 passage, be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to anger. Control that anger, because things could come out that can take years to repair. And so it's really be deliberate. So journaling is another idea. Usually when we get married, we assume the best in each other, right? Oh, she loves me. I know she does. I know we're in this together. We're committed to this. I know even when we disagree, even if I don't like what's going on, I still know her heart is love, and I know she still cares for me. And about 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years into marriage, sometimes that begins to get reversed. Well, why are you saying that? You're out to get me. And it's like we get suspicious of each other. Like, my wife really loves hurting me, and that's what she's out to do. So I can begin to assume make a negative assumption, where usually early in marriage we tend to assume the positive. So this is always a sign, an area I work with couples on, that when they're assuming the negative with each other, to really work with them to say, you got to change your assumption. Now, you can ask your spouse, if you think they're just trying to hurt you, ask them, are you trying to hurt me right now? Which can feel weird sometimes, right? Asking a question like that. But it creates honest conversation at the same time. But I know my wife loves me. We've been married almost 37 years. She still loves me. Now, we have lots of differences, and we can have areas of conflict. But when I'm assuming the worst in her, when I'm thinking she's somehow out to hurt me or get me, then I'm in trouble. First of all, I don't give her the benefit of the doubt. Marriage should be a love relationship. And you remember 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love hopes all things. It bears all things. It's a very patient, gentle feeling that, and it's not just romantic love, it's the love commitment that we have. So often when couples begin assuming the worst in each other rather than the best, that's a sign of trouble, and that you need to change that back.
And that would do it. That would help me.
To remind you, yeah.
He was like, but I'm on your wrong thinking. And that helped. That really helped.
Yeah, with Joyce, I used to always say, I love you. You know, we can be in the middle of a conflict, but just a reminder. We love each other. I did not marry the woman down the street. Yeah. Quiet! No, she didn't do that.
So the writing thing, you know, okay, well, like these days now there's this text and all that, and you have a situation and you send a text message, but sometimes they read something, people, and they take it the other way.
Absolutely.
Like, I really do it, I'm texting. Especially when the situation of rather pick up my phone and say, look, let's talk. You know, like I said, because I'm looking at this, I'm also now doing it in terms of the children, I have older kids.
Right.
And so there's a situation and we need to talk. And they, yeah, sort of, they have this teenage language. So they're texting you.
Right.
Funny looking English and the abbreviated situations. And the way that they just do things, then I'm
right.
Like, oh, okay, he's in trouble. And so usually I don't, especially when there's a situation. So wouldn't be the same problem then when you start writing each other letters and maybe there was a situation and now you've written this letter and somebody reads it with a different tone or they get, you know, they get a completely different meaning from what you meant to say.
There's two things I don't like about texting.
Yeah.
Number one, it's impulsive. It's often... It's not thought through, it's not prayed, it's just blurted. It's kind of like shooting off our mouth. It tends to be done impulse, number one. And number two, it's not private. Anybody who gets the phone and looks at a text can see what people are saying to each other. And so this kind of conversation needs to be private. And it needs to be thoughtful, not impulsive. So if the kids want to text it, I think as a parent, for instance, the right thing to do is say, text to say we need to make it time to talk. We're not going to do this over text. We're going to have a conversation. Email or writing is different because you have to kind of sit and formulate your thoughts. Texting is just kind of like, you know, it's kind of like shouting or talking in the moment by moving your fingers real fast. And so it tends to just be impulse. Does that make sense?
Bad typos sometimes.
Yeah. Bad typos. You may mean to type one thing and say something. But you're right, too, because texting, emailing, writing are one-dimensional. You know, I can write something and my wife can read it and interpret it very, very different. And that's why the marriage journal, texting is very prone. So when you're very thoughtful, when she's writing me, she knows how I tend to think. I mean, she's taking that into consideration when she writes me. When she's texting, she's just firing something, information I need to know, a concern, whatever it might be. she'll text me sometimes, call me. You know, and of course I could say, here it is, call me.
Yeah.
Or I could hear it as, call me. Or I could hear it as, something's going on, I need to talk to you. Yeah, I'm with clients, I'm in session, so it's, we have a little code where if she needs me and I'm in the middle of a meeting with somebody and there's an emergency, we have a little code that when it works, she does it well and I don't always catch it. But when I catch it, we have a secret code. And when that, because I'm not going to sit there watching my phone or answering my phone. And when I catch the code, then I'll tell my client, hey, I need to step out of the office. I need to talk to my wife for a minute and go out and call her privately and then come back in. So that's how we have to handle that. But so, yeah, just a simple text like call me. What tone was in call me? Was it call me? Was it call me? I don't know. Now, she does all caps or put faces on it, maybe, but you know, it's one dimensional. So, but when you're writing, either handwritten or email or something like that, it's prayerful, it's more deliberate. And then because you're writing each other back and forth, you can clarify, hey, when you said that, I don't know, did you mean this or did you mean that? And you can actually ask for clarification. And teenagers, if all they want to do is text, then you may need to use the text to put the boundary down to say, okay, here's how far I'll go with texting, and then we are going to talk. I'm not going to do this via texting. What other questions do you have? We can talk about more ideas if you want, but I want to see what questions you might have. What I'd like for you to do as a church, too, is hold each other accountable here. I would love it if you support each other, even if you don't share specifics with each other, to check in once in a while. Have you done this assessment? Have you gone through it and kind of done a marriage checkup? Are there any areas you and your spouse agreed to work on? You don't have to give me details. I don't need to know specifics. But are you working on them? It's a good tool to create accountability in your friendships, in your relationships with other people. It can be a good tool for that. And one thing I hope when you get, you know, you can even take extra clean copy if you want without the notes on it, but the idea of support each other. Pray for each other. When you see each other in church in a month, say, hey, did you guys pick an area to work on? Yes or no. You don't have to say what it is. Well, how are you doing? Are you working on it? Can we pray for you? And then maybe once a year as a church, you get your married people aside and you go through something like this and say, let's see how we're doing. It's a pretty simple tool, but it really isolates really some of the most important things. What about partner dominance? What about if one of the marriage is feeling abused, controlled, dominated by the other? How do you think that should be handled? It's a lot more serious, isn't it? So if there's physical abuse, if the husband is hurting the wife, if the wife is hitting the husband, if they throw dishes at each other, whatever it might be, now we have a much more serious problem. You really should be in counseling. You should be talking to Jason and Mandy saying, we need to get help. We need to. That becomes dangerous, and people get hurt in marriage when abuse and dominance is allowed. It should never be allowed. And so that's a very serious one. And if you in your relationship or somebody you know encounters that you have to take some kind of action. You can't just ignore that. And this is something in counseling I'll often ask in a counseling setting. Do you ever feel scared of the other person? And I'll ask questions like, what's the worst thing that your husband or wife has done to you? Have they hit you? Have they pushed you? Have they blocked you? You wanted to leave a room and they blocked the door so you couldn't get out. Have they done anything to control you? And I'll always ask for examples of what's the worst thing. The thing we know in counseling is if there's any kind of abuse, you should not be doing marriage counseling with them. First, you do individual counseling. They have to learn to control their anger and make healthier, better choices. Otherwise, they'll have a counseling session, and then what's going to happen out in the parking lot or when they get home? The angry one is going to make them pay. How dare you say something? You shouldn't talk about that. Or I'm so mad at you for saying that or doing that. And so the dominance one is especially an important, concerning one that all of you in your own marriage and any people you know, you should take very, very serious.
So you ask the question, what's the worst thing your spouse has done to you in an individual session? Would you ask that in a...
I wouldn't. In a joint session, I might ask something like, has there been any, you know, abuse or hitting or yelling or whatever? And you can tell, you know, it makes it safe enough that the person will kind of, you'll see them hesitate and hedge, even if they say, well, a little bit. You know, most of the time they won't purely lie and say, oh, no, and say it believable. You can tell. And then I'll always ask, and I meet with each individually a time or two, even if I'm doing marriage counseling, but then I'll ask them privately. So I noticed when I asked that question, you hesitated a little bit. Can we talk about that? What's the worst thing that has happened? Same thing with children. If they've ever dominated or hurt or hit the kids, again, a very serious thing that should be addressed quickly. All violence stops. So aggressiveness is never allowed. Assertiveness, that's different, especially between a husband and wife. I want Joyce to feel safe to express what she feels and thinks, whether I like it or not. I want her to be able to do it. It's a sign of a good marriage. Are there other questions? I know we're getting late and it's a Monday night and everybody's tired, so... Do you think you could use this to follow up in your own and your future husbands too, one day? I hope it's practical enough to be helpful, your fiancé. Well, can I close in prayer then? And then if any of you want to talk to any of us, we can be around. Otherwise, we'll just let the Lord use this and think about it and pray about it and kind of let it percolate in your mind and your heart and your thoughts. Lord, thank you for this patient group. Thank you for their attention and focus. Thank you for their love for you. Thank you for their love for each other. Just bless these marriages, Lord. Encourage them, bless them, strengthen them. And wherever they're doing well, Lord, just give them joy and encouragement. And wherever they have room to grow, Lord, I pray for wisdom to just do slow, gradual improvement. Give them wisdom to focus where you want them to focus, to make things just a little bit better. Give the Holy Spirit, I pray that you would speak to each of them and lead them exactly how you want them to go. I pray for the spouses that weren't able to be here tonight. I pray that as these things are shared, that you would prepare their minds and hearts to be able to have honest, good discussions and set good, positive goals to make marriages even stronger and even better. And for those who aren't married, Lord, we pray that if it's your will, you would bring the right husbands to them. And Lord, make them men of God, cause them to love you and love their future wife. And Lord, that in all of our relationships, we would be an example to a world of what godly marriage looks like. So, Lord, we entrust this evening, pray for safety for everybody on the road to get back home safe. And, Lord, just thank you for the fact that you love us and you are here to help us. And we can call out to you in any way, at any time, and you're there. And we praise you for that in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you, everyone.